Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 29th of February. How often do we get to say that? I'll say it again. The 29th of February. I think this is a pretty substantial change that's taken place and has all kinds of ramifications, and so let's work through some of them. I was reading Time magazine this week, I guess, and there was an interesting piece by the editor of National Review, Rich Lowry, who was responding to the news that after steadily rising for five decades, the share of children born to unmarried women has crossed a threshold. More than half of births to American women under 30 occur outside marriage. He writes that this is very disturbing and that for now the decline of marriage is our most ignored national crisis. As it continues to slide away, our country will become less just and less mobile. That's his thought on this. What does this mean? Why has this happened in American society? And it's evidently been happening in other parts of the world as well, but not as great as here in America. I think we're going to have a lot of response to this. And certainly inside your family structure, this has been occurring, I'm sure, as well for many of you. Our guest is Professor Christina Gibson Davis, Associate Professor of Public Policy, Sociology, Psychology, and Neuroscience at Duke University. She has written extensively on money, marriage, and children, testing the financial expectations and family formation theory, early childhood family structure and mother-child interactions, variation by race and ethnicity, high hopes, but even higher expectations, the retreat from marriage among low-income couples. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We already have several coming in. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Gibson Davis, thank you very much for being with us. I think it'll be an extremely interesting hour.
You're more than welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Tell me why this has happened. Why is it that over half of births, American women under 30, are outside marriage? That's a big thing.
That is a big thing. To start with, it's important to understand that these numbers have been increasing steadily. So although this report has gotten a lot of attention, it's not like we went from 10% of births to more than 50% of births in a relatively short time period. The number has been increasing steadily over the past four decades, as you pointed out. It's just that this number has caught people's attention because suddenly the majority of births are out of wedlock. So why has this happened? A lot of different reasons. There have been changes in women's work roles. There have been changes in the availability of contraception. There have been changes in what we expect a family to look like and whether or not we expect that family to be married. So there have been changes in both societal norms and societal expectations that have gradually made it more acceptable for people to raise children outside the bounds of marriage.
Now, is this that a lot of women are raising children by themselves, or does it mean that we've just forsaken the institution of marriage and there are a lot of people who are cohabitating, but they're not getting married because they don't believe in marriage?
Right. That's an excellent question. I think it has two parts. First, it's true that most of these births, well, 60% of these births will probably be to cohabitating couples. So they'll be born to two-parent families. Mm. But the majority of those cohabitating relationships will have dissolved by the time the child is five. Mm. So they're going to be born to two-parent couples, but they're not going to stay in a two-parent household.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the second question is whether this represents a forsaking of marriage. And our research suggests actually the opposite.
Really?
Yes. People tend to value marriage highly, but most people don't think they're financially prepared for marriage, so they don't get married. But because it's permissible to have children outside of wedlock, they go ahead and have children even if they don't get married. So we see basically a difference in the standards that are associated with what you need to have before you get married, as opposed to what you have before you get a child.
Well, that's interesting. It seems as though thinking might be a little bit off here because you've got to be really financially prepared to have a child.
That is true. If you ask anyone who is married or has a child which one is more expensive, they will undoubtedly tell you that having a child
yes.
is more expensive.
Yes.
Right. I'm sure your listeners would agree with that. But it also has to do with what they see around them. A lot of people who live in single-parent families don't see a lot of people who are married in their communities. And the people that they do see, they think are different than them. And what they think are different about them is that they have money. So they've come to equate these sort of economic expectations with marriage. And they value marriage so highly that they don't want to do it until they have enough money. But they don't see the same prohibition against having children.
Yeah. That's very, very interesting. Now, it really varies by a huge number when you look at how much education a young woman has, doesn't it?
Yes. This is still primarily a phenomena of women with lower levels of education. This is not a phenomena among women who go to a four-year university. Very few of them will have births out of wedlock.
So why?
Well, there are a number of different reasons for that. One is that women with more education tend to want to be economically secure before they have a child. And the opportunity costs, which just means what are they going to give up if they have a baby, are much higher. So if you think you're going to go to college, the last thing you want to do is have a child, because then it's going to make it much more difficult for you to go on to college. And maybe when you're starting your career, that's not a good time either, because you're worried about how it's going to interrupt your career path.
Mm-hmm.
But for women with less education, they don't have those same opportunities.
Mm.
So the foregone cost of having a child is a lot lower. Mm-hmm. They're not giving up a four-year degree. They're not giving up a promising career by having a child.
What are they giving up?
For low-income women?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's not a lot of evidence that they're giving up a whole lot. That because they have fairly limited occupational choices and educational choices, there's not a lot of evidence that they're giving up much at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact... Go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
Well, and in fact, it could be that mothering is really important to who they are, and mothering is an area where they can demonstrate their worth and their confidence in ways that they can't do, in the work world. So it may be fulfilling to them to have a child when they don't have many other opportunities.
And yet you would think, and please tell me how this is playing out in people's lives, that economically it would be a huge struggle to do that. Because if you have a low-paid job, which most of these women do, you've got childcare expenses that are out of this world. How do you manage? How do you get by? You've got two people to take care of instead of yourself.
Yeah, well, the answer is not well, I think. I mean, that the highest concentration of poverty in this country is among single mothers, which is why people are concerned about this really high rate of non-marital births, because suddenly we are looking at an increasing number of people who are likely to be poor. So the answer is it's not very easy to do. And a lot of low-income women will scramble to find childcare arrangements. They have unstable childcare arrangements that fall through, and it's a real effort.
Right. What does the research show about how children's lives are affected by this out-of-wedlock birth rate? We keep reading that they have increased risks of being poor, of not doing well in school, of having behavioral problems, emotional problems. Do your studies show that?
So what the research suggests is that it's really hard to understand what the causal effect of marriage is, right? So what we want to know is, if a couple gets married, will that cause their kid to do better than a couple who's not married? That's really what we care about, right? But the problem is that people who get married may look different from people who don't get married. So if I get married, I might be more responsible, I might have better psychological health, I might be able to maintain relationships, and all of that may affect my ability to parent a child in ways that are different than those who don't get married. So it's really hard to disentangle what's the causal effect of marriage and what's the causal effect of the types of people who get married. That being said, there are lots and lots of studies that show that almost on every outcome, children born to single mothers do worse than children born to married, stable homes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to phone calls. We have tons of people who want to weigh in on this, and they were calling in very early. We're talking about what I think is significant. I grew up in a different era, so I take in this headline, and I'm not sure what to do with it. Maybe you're in the same boat I am. For women under 30, most births occur outside marriage, the headline of a New York Times article on February 17. It used to be called illegitimacy, the article begins, but now it is the new normal. After steadily rising for five decades, the share of children born to unmarried women has crossed a threshold. More than half of births to American women under 30 occur outside marriage. 800-486-8655 is our number, and let's go to Nicholas in Watertown for our first call. Hi, Nicholas.
Hi. Thank you for this very vital subject and your expert. What has happened is the media has made the woman a sex object. We know a woman is a personality, intelligent, good, but Playboy magazine, all the media, the movies, you know, the woman is a sex, the Italian mafia, girly joints, the woman is a sexual object, which is not true. And this was a habit also. When young people go on a date, they should have a chaperone. You know, young people have cars. They go on a date, and what do they do in the car?
I don't know. A chaperone. Now, there's a word that I haven't heard in a long time. Until what age do you think, Nicholas?
Well, I tell you, I think it should be done like 21 or 20. I tell you, most dates of young people, they're sexual relationships. So we got to stop that. It's, you know, years ago, many years ago, you know, like in Spain, when a young woman and a man went on a date, they had a chaperone.
Yeah, all right. Professor Gibson Davis.
Well, I think your caller raises a really interesting point, which is, what are the age of these women that are counting for these births? And it's actually not teenagers. Teenagers have declined as a fraction of all non-marital births. They used to be upwards of 60%, and now it's down to 21%. So it's actually not the teenagers in the back of the car who are accounting for most of this phenomena. It's women in their 20s. Now, maybe that means we need chaperones for 20-year-olds. But
maybe.
But the caller raises a really good point about what age are we talking about. So that is worth clarifying.
Hmm. So, and let's do a little bit of an analysis of why the out-of-wedlock birth rate has gone down. Among teenagers, teenage pregnancy rate is down. We've done something right.
We have done something right. Though we don't quite understand why teenagers have sex or why teenagers stop having sex, we do know that they're getting better at using contraception. Mm. They're more likely to report using it the first time they have sex and the last time they use sex. So that undoubtedly has contributed to the decline in the teenage pregnancy rate.
Mm-hmm.
It's also clear that if you give teenagers, I mentioned the phrase opportunity cost earlier, but that's just a fancy way of saying what else is out there. And it's also clear that if teenage girls know what else is out there for them, that they're going to try and step up their efforts to avoid a teenage pregnancy.
Yeah. Thank you, Nicholas, very much. I certainly hadn't thought of chaperones. It hadn't entered my mind, but it's an interesting thought. John is next. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I too get a giggle out of that chaperone term. I would suggest that, you know, I remember my sons going to high school and they're taught economics and how to go into a store and read a label of calories and products and whatnot into it. I think that we should also teach what are the ramifications if you get a woman pregnant, and, you know, are you going to step up to the plate and help her or not, or what it's going to cause her in grief, whether it's financial, mental, or whatever, in the long term, if you decide to, you know, hey, jump ship and back out. You know, I think the male species itself is, I don't know how it's come to this point, but it is at fault for this. Men don't step up to the plate. Oh, yeah, you know, we'll come and play, but then we back off and go away when the responsibility time sets in. And I can imagine this is going to probably take a generation or so to inculcate this into men's minds. But she's mine, you know, and I can just throw her away when I'm done with her.
Professor Gibson Davis.
Well, again, it is, your caller raises a very good point that the disproportionate burden of having the child is going to be on the mom. And not only is that because the child's most likely going to go live with the mom, but because there aren't a lot of ways to make the dad sort of do his part if he doesn't want to. The childcare system in the United States is fairly broken. It doesn't collect a lot of money, even when it does collect money. So it's not a very good way to make fathers pay. So we're really relying on men themselves to, as your caller said, step up to the plate. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, a lot of fathers don't do that. And there are a lot of fathers exit the picture really quickly. And then the burden does fall on the mom and, of course, on the child.
And do we have studies on that? You mentioned that a lot of these cohabitation relationships fall apart by the time the child is 5 years old. Do the fathers stay involved in the lives of their children, or they just become absent at that point?
So there's a lot of variation, and I don't want to say that all cohabitating fathers exit the picture, but a large fraction will. And will become absent from the child's life. Now, that may also be because the mother doesn't want him involved for whatever reason. It's not always just the dad disappearing, but it is true that once the relationship ends, contact is dramatically reduced.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, John, for the call. Liz in Green Bay, hi.
Good morning, and thank you for having me. I think I may be an outlier because when I was 40, I had a child the traditional way, had my birth child, but I wasn't married and hadn't made any plans to be married, and I would subsequently foster and adopt two additional children. So now in my mid-50s, I'm in middle school, elementary, and high school. And one of the things that there's many aspects of which you speak this morning that I could comment on, but there are a couple things in terms of me being, not only am I a college graduate, but I'm I have my MBA, so I have a graduate degree as well. And me, it was my friends in our late 30s were starting to think about families and were having difficulty. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I never thought about having children, but I never said no. So at the gentleman that I was dating at the time, I informed him I was going to try and get pregnant. And very short story, I successfully got pregnant and would start my single parenthood. But my two children that I subsequently fostered and adopted, my two younger ones, I have a very open adoption, and they come from the other end of the outlier, a teenage mother.
Oh.
And interesting enough, we have very open and adoption, and we were successful in my middle child finding her father, her birth father, and he's very involved in terms of letters and phone calls. But for me, it was marriage wasn't particularly something I aspired for, and I thought the time was running out. And I have to say, having children changed my life completely because I was traveling, had a very demanding job, and would subsequently have to change my career in order to be the kind of parent that I wanted to be.
How do you do all of this by yourself, Liz?
Well, I'm often asked that. And I have to say, to my friends that are in a traditional marriage with children, I often say, you know, when I look at you, you're doing almost as much as I'm doing, and I'm getting all the credit. Because even though they may have a spouse that may chauffeur someone to the doctor's office, they have to remember to make an appointment. They have to remind them. Their spouse, and I'm generalizing, I realize, but their spouse is a helper versus an equal partner. So I'd like to take more credit, but I really don't think I get that much credit because I think traditional marriage women, by and large, are still carrying the bulk of the weight of all this.
Professor Gibson Davis.
Well, I think what your caller raises is this basic separation of marriage from fertility. So she mentioned that she wanted to get pregnant without really thinking about marriage. And I think overall what we're talking about is the fact that childbearing has become disconnected from marriage. 50 years ago, you just assumed that childbearing was within the context of marriage. That's not the case anymore. So because of this disconnect, you see people making all kinds of different choices, like the choice that your caller made. I would also just say that she is an outlier. She described herself as such. And the number of women in their late 30s who have children on their own is a relatively small fraction of non-marital births.
We just pay a lot of attention to them for some reason,
yes.
Don't we?
Well, we have Dan Quayle originally to thank for
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
I date myself, so half of your listeners probably haven't heard of Dan Quayle. But that, you know, the Murphy Brown issue, but that's really a very, very tiny fraction of women with non-marital births.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you did the right thing. You're having a glorious time, Liz.
Oh, I'm having such a glorious time. I don't even know what day of the week it is.
It's February 29th.
So it'll pass too fast, and I agree. So
yes,
I am savoring it. I am savoring it.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. What about the editor of the National Review talking about the fact that this is a national crisis, the decline of marriage, and he urges Michelle Obama to step up to the plate. We'll talk about why, what he said, and get our guest's response to this. We're talking this hour about the number of women under 30 having children out of wedlock, and it is now over half. A number that's been going up steadily for decades, but now it is over half. Our guest this hour is Professor Christina Gibson Davis, Associate Professor of Public Policy, Sociology, and Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Senator George McGovern will be with us. He has written yet another book, What It Means to Be a Democrat. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And before we go back to more phone calls, Christina, this is an interesting idea. I'm sure you saw Rich Lowry's article in Time magazine. He called this a national crisis, and he says that marriage needs a spokeswoman. I quote here, Michelle Obama is the daughter in a traditional two-parent family and the mother in another one that even her husband's critics admire. If she took up marriage as a cause, she could ultimately have a meaningful impact on the lives of children than she will ever have urging them to do jumping jacks. What do you say to that?
I'm not going to weigh in on the relative merits of marriage versus obesity, because that's a little outside my area. But again, it goes to what we think the problem is. If we think the problem is that people aren't getting married because they don't value marriage, then maybe we need people to encourage them to get married. If we think people aren't getting married because they don't have enough money to get married, then it's not clear that encouraging people to get married is really going to work. We actually just concluded a series of experiments. These were done in various cities around the U.S., where we had other researchers had couples come in, and they had counseling, and they learned to communicate. And this whole idea was to promote them to get married. These were couples who said, I'm interested in marriage. Please tell me more about it. Give me some help. And the program was spectacularly unsuccessful at getting people to get married.
Oh.
It just didn't work.
Huh.
And even though these were good skills, you know, how do you resolve conflict and what do you do when you fight about money and how do you meet your spouse's needs and things like that? But it's really hard to get people to get married. It's a fairly personal decision. So I'm not sure that having a spokesperson for marriage would have much of an effect if people have other concerns about why they're not getting married.
Yeah. Doug in Oshkosh. Hi. Hey there, Doug.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry, Gene. Gene, good morning, and your Professor Davis, thank you. A few comments and then a question. In Bill O'Reilly's book, A Bold, Fresh Piece of Humanity, he says the cause of poverty in the United States is fatherless children. And we went from 5% in 1960 to 35%, and unfortunately, the black population has 70% of fatherless children. They represent 70% of the people in prison, 70%, over 70% of the school dropouts, over 60% of the rapes are caused by them, a high rate of suicide. I know two guys, one with six, one with 11 children. They both have minimal jobs, drug problems, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They aren't involved in their family. They have no social conscience, in my estimation. They just are producing children. That is a horrible problem. So my question is, first of all, Is this problem going to get even worse than what it is? And then I have a very bold question for you. Why don't we pay some men, these these guys I know are on, they're on drugs and they would jump at the chance of getting $200-$300 if we'd pay them to have a vasectomy.
All right, Professor, go right ahead.
Well, as to the first question as to whether or not this problem is going to get worse, it's certainly not going to get any better. I mean, it depends on what you think the problem is. In terms of the fatherlessness issue, again, we as a society don't generally do a very good job of encouraging unwed dads to be involved in their kids' lives. And as that becomes sort of more of a norm, then it sort of becomes self-perpetuating. Right. So as other dads see other dads not being involved, then it does perpetuate itself. So, as to whether or not fatherless children are going to get worse, at least statistically, the numbers are certainly headed upward. I don't know about paying dads to have vasectomies. That's a little outside the policy solutions I usually consider. But again, it has to do with individual choices and what are the consequences of those choices. And perhaps there are things we can do short of vasectomies to encourage responsibility among young men.
Yeah. And it is an issue, certainly. I don't mean to make light of it. There is, and I have known some of these young people. I've done some mentoring of teens. This perception that it's cool, you know, you're a dad, you don't think about the child or take care of the child after he or she is born. But, you know, you got a lot of notches under your belt. You've been virile. You've fathered a lot of children. That in itself is a sign of, I'm not sure what, that I'm, you know, I can father a lot of children.
And again, it goes to what I was saying earlier about what are these men giving up? So not much,
right?
So if you're going to derive your identity from being a father or for creating babies, as opposed to deriving your identity from, you know, educational or vocational or career paths, then people need to create identities. And perhaps one of the things we could do is to help young men see other opportunities for ways that they could demonstrate their worth.
Yeah, exactly. When you mentioned, I wanted to ask you more about money. When you mentioned this is a big thing that they don't have enough money to get married, how much is enough money?
Our study suggests it's basically a middle class income. So people want to have two stable jobs. They want to be able to afford a mortgage, so put together a down payment. Weddings are very important. They want to, you know, I call it the Martha Stewartization of weddings. They don't want to go to the justice of the peace. They want to have a wedding like they think middle class people have. They want to have savings. So it's a collection of what we call goods that resembles a middle class lifestyle. And because there's no inherent deadline for getting married, right? There's no time at which you're supposed to be married. They can just keep putting marriage off while they work on these economic goals. And for a lot of people, those economic goals are just simply never going to be realized. And right. So they're never going to get married.
Right. Let's go to Samantha in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I just had a quick question, maybe a little bit more of a comment. But I'm 24. I'm from a low-income neighborhood, originally on the south side of Chicago. And just about every female that I graduated high school with, I think, has since had a child. And I noticed, I think, the difference mostly between myself and them is that while they mostly came from two-parent families, my mother has a higher level of education than most of their families, and I was wondering if that was something that you had looked into at all, or if that just goes along with the opportunity that you were talking about.
Yes, education is a huge thing. And again, my guess is, not knowing anything about your mother, is that she had opportunities that she experienced because of her education that maybe some of those other parents hadn't. And she wanted those same opportunities for you. So she knew what an education could get you. And my guess is that's part of the reason why you graduated from high school, is that was important to her and, you know, something, a value she passed down to you. So education plays a critical role in this whole phenomena, and where do women want to be, and can they see themselves getting there?
Thank you.
Thanks, Samantha. Kathy in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi, thank you so much. This program is just My analysis of this over many years is that, in general, people don't accept the responsibilities in marriage or childcare. They don't devote enough time to making a success of both. And with the that combined with the media's selling of sex, it's no wonder the kids are engaged in sex like rabbits. And consequently, the children of many of these unions are lacking the boy who disappears and a girl who is not in any position to be able to crawl out of the poverty she's going to be in for a long time.
Again, I would just point out that teenagers are only 20% of non-marital births, so you could make the argument that teenagers are receiving a lot of messages about sex. I mean, I think the caller raises an excellent point that they're just bombarded with those sexual messages. But their teenage pregnancy rates have actually declined. So it seems like there's a lot going on. Undoubtedly, the media plays one role, but it's probably not the entire story.
Thank you, Kathy, for the call. Joe in Washburn, hi.
Hello. I think I have a little different take on this. I have I'm a father who had three boys and a daughter, and two of my boys they're contractors. They both earn very, very good incomes. Their girlfriends, their longtime girlfriends, of course, were living with them. Both of those ladies became pregnant from my sons, and when my sons immediately said, you know, and these were at different times, but said that they decided to get married, they were actually counseled not to at the time.
Really?
Yes, because what they tried to do was they said, I'm going to get married. I want to put my wife on my insurance policy. The insurance policy company said, basically, you don't really want to do that because, first of all, your wife has a pre-existing condition. Your to-be-wife will have a pre-existing condition, and we won't insure her. And the baby also will not be covered, and especially even in the future, you'll never get the baby covered if the baby has any kind of malady. And so it really came out for both of those guys to be a huge risk factor. I can tell you now that they are married, they have even more kids, and they're great family guys. They're both excellent, excellent father figures within their households. But the system of health insurance, kept them from getting married to the girl they love so much.
Oh, my. Professor.
That's an interesting story. I'm not aware of any studies that have looked at the relationship between health insurance and marriage and whether or not that keeps people from getting married. But I take the caller's larger point that there might be some things we could do as a society to make marriage easier. There might be some changes we could make to laws that would make it more economically attractive. And perhaps health insurance is one example of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, both of them had insurance, but then mm-hmm. they were not allowed to put their wife on it. If that lady is pregnant, that was considered a pre-existing condition, and they weren't allowed, you know, they weren't able to put them on their policy. So, you know, put yourself out there having a business, having all the liabilities of a business, and the potential of what could happen to your business if something disastrous happens during birth or anything like that.
So what did they do, Joe?
Well, what they did, of course, you know, when you're not married, I hate to say this, but they're taken care of by the state. This wasn't the state of Wisconsin, but there were social programs that could take care of them. After the children were born, you know, I mean, they paid some out-of-pocket expenses in that. But basically, the burden of liability, you know, kind of rested outside, you know, on the state. Well, after the children were born, then they got married, you know, and then they were able to put the family on the policy.
I see. Well, that's interesting. Maybe somebody ought to look at that. I don't know how widespread that is. Thank you.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how widespread that is either.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, a lot of insurance policies will let you put a spouse onto their insurance policy, even if they have a pre-existing condition. And I'm not sure you're allowed to consider pregnancy a pre-existing condition anymore, but
right.
That's certainly not my area of expertise.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe, very much for the call. Ruth in Shawano, hi.
Hello. Hey, I've been there. I have 10 children, all unplanned.
You have 10 children?
Yes. I haven't heard the mention of the influences of the Catholic Church. And this is where I was at many years ago. All pregnancies were considered a gift from God. And I guess I have to agree this late in life, but I would have much rather been able to plan. They didn't have Planned Parenthood at that time. So anyhow, I mentioned of the influences of the church. I haven't, I'm not aware that there is that influence anymore. So I'm just want to mention that.
All right. Thank you, Ruth. That's a lot of pregnancies. That's a lot.
Yes, that is a lot of pregnancies.
Yeah.
Yes, we don't talk much about the religious influence anymore. In general, the majority of Americans are sort of pro-contraception, and there are some, of course, who don't believe to use it for religious reasons, but in general, people are pro-contraception. So this having children because the church doesn't believe in contraception, I don't think accounts for a lot of the births that we're seeing today.
Thank you, Ruth, for the call. Let's go to Steve in West Bend. Hi, Steve.
Hi. The other caller talking about the health insurance, quite honestly, I think a lot of these women, they get this attitude that they really don't want anything to do with a man other than basically have them for sex. I mean, it works both ways. The women enjoy the sex as much as the men do. There's a lot of men that are very responsible. Unfortunately, our state is one of the best states that make it very attractive for women and giving them enough money to help support some of their kids, and this has got to be stopped. It's like we did back in the 60s and 70s when we had a tremendous amount of black people moving into our state and down in Milwaukee until they changed some of those advantages black people were having, and I'm not just focusing on them, but it was a very profitable situation for them to keep having children. You know, unless this changes the attitude and with women, we're going to have a culture that's going to be devastating. You're going to have kids that grow up without any family structure, unless they're lucky to have good grandparents.
Where are they getting the money? Why is it profitable? Would you say, Steve?
What's that?
Why is it profitable? How are they making out with money? Having children.
Well, because the state is profitable for it. It's not profitable, but they get their kids, they get enough money that helps them get by. That's another said about the insurance. They don't. I have friends of my son that have been together for 5-6 years, and they have, 3-4-year-old kids, but yet they stay not to get married. The kid owns 3 different houses, and they have a beautiful daughter, but they stay not to get married because the daughter is still collecting the benefits that come along with not being married and having a child. My brother did the same thing, 35 years ago. And it's very common. It's right here in Wisconsin. You can see it all around. If you talk to half of these mothers, these single mothers, if you're out there only making $10-$12 an hour, and they're lucky to be doing that unless they have some kind of education that's going to get them in elsewhere, it's very, very tough.
Professor Gibson Davis.
So there are actually very few monetary supports for single moms. The average welfare benefit is about $200, $250 a month, and that's if you qualify. So it's not a lot of cash. You can get some food stamps, of course, but of course, I don't know the particulars of the situation the caller's talking about, but having a child really doesn't pay and hasn't paid for a long time. And all the studies that try and see, do states with more generous welfare benefits, do they have more moms with more single moms? And there's a very weak relationship. It does not seem that if you live in a more generous, what we call welfare state, that encourages moms to have kids. It's a fairly common perception that welfare causes moms to have kids, but the evidence just isn't there.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Christina Gibson Davis, Associate Professor of Public Policy, Sociology, and Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. And we're talking about, I don't think this has received a lot of attention. So, you know, we read this and thought, let's do a show on it. Now the new normal is to not be married if you're a woman under the age of 30 when you have a child. More than half of births to American women under 30 occur outside marriage. And when you break those statistics down, the more educated you are, the more likely you are to be married. That the reason given by many young people is that they're waiting to have enough money to get married. So we're analyzing all of this hour. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go next to Kathy in Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a nephew and a hopefully niece-to-be. They live in another state, so they're not listening to this, thank God. They had their first child in December of 2010, and they're planning on getting married in September of this year. I hope it goes through. He seems like he's a very devoted dad. But my niece-to-be said she wanted to posted this on Facebook, that she wanted to see if he would be a good and committed father before she married him.
Oh, my.
And that seems to me, and her friends were saying, oh, how wonderful. And I'm thinking, that's back-assward. I am, pardon my French, but that's just really taking a big risk. How is this a common way of thought anymore? And one other point, I'm in my mid-40s. I've been married almost 23 years. We didn't have a bunch of money when we got married. We weren't going to live the middle-class lifestyle immediately. Do they think what they see on TV is reality? Everybody's supposed to live that way? I don't get it. Okay, thanks.
All right, thanks, Kathy.
So, you know, just to the first point about, is this idea that I want to see what my partner's going to be like before I get married? It goes to, again, this question of how much they value marriage. And people don't want to go into a marriage unless they know it's going to work out. And again, since there's no sort of inherent deadline, they can put off getting married until they sort of gather more information, which it sounds like is what the niece is doing. So that's not an uncommon approach to marriage. And as for whether how much money they have, it's a difference as to where we are on the life path. So it used to be you got married and maybe you didn't have a lot of money, but you expected that you would earn more money once you got married and you sort of grew older and grew more established. Now you're expected to get established first and then get married, as opposed to doing it the other way around.
Deborah in Madison, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Deborah.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am calling because I'm in a long-term relationship with my wife. We're two women. We're just about to celebrate our 25 years together.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank
long
you.
Time.
And we have two children that we plan for very... it's very difficult to have children if you're a same-sex couple. And I am wanting to know if you've addressed any of this, is how, like, we want to be married and we're not allowed to be legally married. I mean, of course, we went to Canada and got legally married, but in the state of Wisconsin, you cannot be legally married. And how, our two children, our oldest now is in college and doing very well at a prestigious college, and then our second one is doing very well also, and she's in middle school. We homeschool because we just really want to be with our children. And my point is that with planning for children so well, that we've dedicated our lives to our children, and even though they would look like on paper that they're belong to single moms, they're not. Mm. And so it might skew your surveys or your research, because there are a lot of us out there, a lot of single, quote, single lesbian couples and gay couples that do have children and are extremely responsible.
Professor?
Yes, yeah, so that's certainly a growing segment of the population of, you know, same-sex couples raising children. Again, my guess is that a lot of those couples have higher levels of education, so they're going to look different than other single moms who may have lower levels of education. So it's not only a sexual orientation difference, it's also an educational difference. And that's a fairly important point in thinking about this issue.
And did you say, I wasn't clear, Deborah, did you say you went to Canada to get married?
Yes.
And was it important for you to do that before you had the children or not?
Oh, it wasn't legal at that time to in Canada because we've been together 25 years.
Oh, okay.
And it's only been legal in Canada, I think, like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have a wedding in our church.
I see.
So we were very committed to each other before we started having children.
Thank you very much for the call. That takes us in a whole different direction, doesn't it? It's interesting that she called.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I would just want to say that she raised the question of wantedness of children. And it is important to note that a lot of these births to unmarried women are either what we call mistimed or not wanted. So there is this perception that the birth may have come not when they wanted it to have come. So there is that question of then how does that sort of affect the life course of those children?
Mm. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Deborah, for your call. Let's go to a couple of emails here. My daughter is a single mother. My husband and I have had to step in with support, financial and otherwise. The sexual revolution of the 60s seems to have resulted in dependency among baby boomers' children.
Well, like a lot of revolutions, it cuts in a lot of different directions, right? So there aren't many women who would say they want to go back to a time when their roles were prescribed for them and their identities were laid out for them. But it is also true that we have more choices than there are more consequences for our actions. So it's sort of a trade-off between the way it was in 1960 and the way it is in 2012.
Sarah in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'll try to make it quick. I have two comments. First of all, one being that I'm a labor and delivery nurse in Madison, so I see all walks of life having children, couples, single moms, everything. We have a foreign population. I'm thinking mostly of our younger Hmong girls who are maybe married in their culture, but it's not legally recognized in the U.S., so that could be results. And also commenting on the earlier gentleman's comment about the insurance not covering a pre-existing condition. I recently had a couple who that happened to them where they were married during the pregnancy. His insurance would not cover her, and then she no longer qualified for state because her income had increased. So everything that they had was out of pocket. And
oh, goodness.
Considering her stay, it would have been thousands and thousands and enough to definitely put them in debt.
Well,
yeah, so again, that goes back to our earlier point about whether or not we can change policies to avoid situations like that.
Well, if we're going to encourage marriage and think that it's a good thing for society, you can't have those kinds of policies, right?
That would seem to be, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Another email, there's going to be a bill introduced today, evidently, in Wisconsin, the Child Abuse and Neglect Prevention Board, emphasizing non-marital parenthood as a contributing factor to child abuse and neglect, connecting single parenthood to child maltreatment, according to our email from Lana, seems overly simplistic and disrespectful. Yes, single parenthood might be a risk factor, but of all things that contribute significantly to child abuse, such as domestic violence, drug use, etc., singling out single parents and emphasizing it over other factors is wrong. What do you think?
I'm sympathetic to that viewpoint. It also seems to me it's treating the symptom and not the cause. If abuse is arising because the parent doesn't have enough money and is stressed all the time and can't make it on a low-wage job, then there might be more effective ways to help that parent rather than through a punitive process.
And looking at money, which always factors into anything, if more people were doing better, if we didn't have the unemployment rate that we have, if people weren't had more promising jobs, family wage-earning jobs, do you think we'd see a whole different trend in this country toward more marriage?
I think it would take some time, but I think that there would be more people getting married. Now, it might not be a huge increase. There are other factors that play into this decision, but I think it would help.
Yeah. Well, hasn't this been an interesting hour? Thank you so much. And thanks to the callers who added just dimensions I hadn't even thought of. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Our guest, Professor Christina Gibson Davis, Associate Professor of Public Policy, Sociology and Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. She's done a great deal of research on the causes and consequences of marriage among low-income parents, the health and well-being of low-income children. We thank her for her expertise. And you know, if you want to read a viewpoint that really called for marriage, too, the current issue of Time Magazine, done by the editor of National Review, Just Not the Marrying Kind, A Deepening Trend in Out-of-Wedlock Births, shouldn't be impossible to reverse. He's very concerned about that trend, and it's different. It's really a change in American society, isn't it? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, where, whoo-wee, it's foggy. A lot of fog. But I know you have a lot of snow in other parts of the state, so I guess we'll take the fog. Sorry. Tomorrow, we will be with you. Jeremy Scahill is going to be with us. Jeremy is from the Milwaukee area. He's a heck of a writer and a pretty fearless soul who has spent a great deal of time in Yemen and writes about a disturbing article about who's running the country and where counterterrorism dollars are going. And Senator George McGovern, the second hour of our show. Great conversations ahead. Stay with us.